threat seriously. Is emerging as one of the greatest threats of the next millennium.
Dear, dear. Dear, dear.
Bacteria. 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 Bacteria.
How other people perceive us and how we perceive them perceiving us. I think it's really a book about being looked at and being seen and seeing yourself both through your own eyes, other people's eyes, and learning to tell the difference between those two sets of eyes.
In the chilling terms of military calculation, biological weapons can be the most potent of the so-called weapons of mass destruction. In an attack on a large city with an average density of population, a 300-kilogram chemical weapon could kill 3,000 people. A nuclear weapon weighing perhaps 200 kilograms might kill up to 40,000 people. But only 30 kilograms of anthrax, if sprayed over the city on a still day, could kill twice as many people.
Risk in talking about warning signs that people will think it means someone's about to go berserk, and no warning sign tells us that. Until the man shows up in camouflage with multiple weapons, you don't know for sure it's going to happen.
Automatically see the individual in the box as a victim of a great big man-made environment and would point an angry finger at the big powers that create these vicious environments that make these miserable victims possible.
There's a man with a paper sitting alone. He drinks his martini, fingers the phone, and he's leaning back in a comfortable chair. Upstairs, she's got her mama's soft dress on, telling you hat. She's twirling around, teasing the cat, and she's looking for changes. Patient with time, she's got a bow in her hair, and her shoes are all shine. Work all day, sleep all night, live in the
dedicated to the clothing business. Only a grandfather was a writer. Irving Layton. He was not born into this life. He was born into a well-to-do Jewish family dedicated to the clothing business.
David Barsamian.
Vision has become one of the most frequent words in the English language, I think. It's incumbent on every journalist who's commenting on the administration and its activities to throw the word vision in at least three or four times, usually with the adjective grand or something in front of it. It's true that every president has to come along with a vision. That's part of the tools of the trade. But this one has really reached a peak of exuberance and exposure that goes a bit beyond the norm. Well, the vision was announced. There were two phases to it. There was an announcement and then the achievement to bring the announcement to reality. The announcement was in the last couple of days of September. There were three or four days there where there was a series of speeches by the President, Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, the Ambassador of the UN, all of which presented the Clinton vision of foreign policy. And then in the following months, particularly in November, came the realization of the vision, both foreign and domestic. first with the passage of what is misleadingly called the North American Free Trade Agreement. It's not totally misleading. It does have to do with North America. So that version of NAFTA was the major achievement. That was followed immediately by an anti-crime bill and by the triumph at the Asian Pacific Summit out in Seattle. That's what I want to talk about, the vision, the announcement, the achievement. And I think the easiest way to do it is to kind of unravel it backwards. So let's start with the end.
Good evening out there. Still be a ZBC. From that bootleg town where people walk the streets with impunity. Eastern Massachusetts. And where they drive slow. To keep the keep here in Newton. December 7, full moon 95, another night in America, 90.3, that's where you are. If you don't have your papers, get out of town. Or go set a toll booth teller on fire. It's a free country. New Metaphysics on the air. Gary Geiserman on the lead guitar. Hosts and hordes of others spiraling their way up from the ionic matrix of our technique. Doing the human thing on planet Earth for a while longer. Phase one, act the last. It's been a good show, but like all good things, it's time we knew to decide, to choose, to kick that sucker away. Wheat from the chaff kind of thing on the big blue planet. WZBC sings in the new era. New Year's Eve kind of thing. Darkest before the dawn. another episode of New Metaphysics. We'll try it again until we get this damn thing right, or die trying. I think I'll decide to choose the latter. Five five two 4686. We're digitized here. Press some buttons and go live. For source material, of course. Otherwise, stand away from those speakers. Those mighty translators sitting in your room or on the control panel as you cruise the interstate. Velocity is too high now. Window for ejection has passed. I repeat, window for ejection has passed. Window for ejection has passed. Window for ejection has passed.
Grandfather was a writer.
I knew him in the last year or so of his life. He lived at our house. I had the feeling that he was especially happy that I had become a writer. We were both writing at the time. He was becoming senile. But in his senility, there were great lapses of poetry.
This iris you took, it is of a milk bottle on a tenement fire escape, and just below it you see an unconscious, apparently vagrant, lying in an alley. How did you come to take this picture, and how do you feel about it now? I mean, I know it was taken many years ago.
Yes. The picture itself really doesn't interest me so much as the process that I used for it, and that is the black and white with red process and the colors. Obviously, I must have done 16 shows after this, and this is my first one to set up that series of all my photographs being in black and white with one touch of red, which is very hard to photograph. I mean, you have to go to a lot of work to remove all color when you're using color film.
Well, for the sake of the listener, what part of this photograph is in red?
Oh, well, the blood from the man's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously the red, and that's what I wanted to stand out. However, he did have blood on his shirt and around his feet. There was a pool of blood around his head, too, which I had to wash out.
Mm-hmm.
And the bricks, of course, were red, and I had to get rid of the red in the bricks. And there was a sunset going on, and so I had to get rid of the red from there. I really am quite proud of it. I really am quite proud of it.
Andre, anything about the photograph?
I felt when I was looking at it that that iris was approaching a new level of perception with respect to her subjects, that in spite of the fact that she was intending to heavily process this photograph until the red would come out, and of course in her photographs all the time I notice a very excellent composition, I must compliment too. The center of the subject is very far down on the lower right-hand corner, and I felt that her mind was not only on the subject, but elsewhere too. And this was what indicated to me that she was bringing in the other concepts of what was going on in her mind. It was not only this photograph, her mind was not focused on only this subject, but it was elsewhere. And that is what I felt was interesting about this
one. Yeah, that's an interesting thing, because I felt that because of that positioning of the focal point of the picture basically being in the lower right-hand corner, I did not feel that this was where her mind was. I felt that it was an indication of a world out of kilter, in which the entire world that is summoned up in a picture of plenty in the form of a bottle of milk.
Milk, and, yes, that's
And a complete degradation, really, in the form of a man homeless, battered, lying below it. And it is as though a life out of kilter, and that they are being drawn off and away from the picture, as though the picture can hardly hold these images within it, and that in fact these people are being sucked out of the world.
What people can spot and do something about, however, is employees who are making other people uncomfortable and who are themselves uncomfortable or overwhelmed.
Its private individual orientation to the environmental orientation.
In May 1966, shortly after the Watts riot, a black man named Leonard Deadwater was driving his pregnant wife to the hospital. A white police officer stopped Mr. Deadwater for speeding. After the cars had stopped, the police officer accidentally shot and killed Mr. Deadwater.
How did it change for you?
How did it change? Very slowly and gradually. There was no one moment of revelation where I thought, hallelujah, I'm cured.
Cured meaning accepting yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
And
it's funny, I say in the book, you know, I had cancer, I had this horrific physical thing happen to me, but the story is about looking different, you know, it was the emotional trauma. And there was no moment when I sort of overcame that, where I saw the blinding light. It was more that all along I possessed the capability to have moments of understanding, and I guess you could call them transcendence, moments of joy versus many moments of sorrow.
Caravan over to the other hotel only to have to turn around again, yes?
Not your ego, no, but walk away from your negative ego and the codependency that is so utterly destructive and so utterly damaging to you and into your reality. Now, over the many years that we have been talking, certainly we have spoken of negative ego so very many, many times. We have done evenings, certainly so, dealing with the negative ego in busting and building ego. And we have talked about it on every weekend and every intensive, at least to remind you, to alert you to the impact that your negative ego can have, the damage, the destruction, the utter terror that it can produce in its ultimate desire to destroy you. The ego can take away what you have strived, what you have worked, what you have grown to accomplish. It doesn't have to. It certainly does have no power to do it alone. But it can take it away. Yes, the negative ego can be totally destructive, absolutely so, and in minutes, and that's so important to understand. Sure, you can tell, you can have this indiscretion or that infidelity, you can tell this lie, you can shortcut manipulation here and there, you can believe one of your delusions, and it may have no impact on you at all, it may have no deleterious or damaging impact whatsoever, but the next one might. And if not the next one, maybe the one after that. And if not that one, then perhaps the... And you just never know.
That's not a warning of violence. That's a warning of a person with a problem. And all of this begins with troubled employees in need of assistance.
This is from Andy to Greg Dunn. It's a message of love coming out to you. Listen up, Greg Dunn. Here on ZBC and Newton, New Metaphysics, Gary Geiserman presiding. It's a white shout out, if you will.
He didn't encounter me in the hallway, not recognize me, and then said, "Oh, you're the writer." You know, as if he'd found some guarantee of the extension of his own soul.
One of my most deepest connections that I have is actually not with a visual artist, it's with a poet. There is a Persian poet from the 13th century by the name of Jalal al-Din Rumi, who has given the world some of the most exquisite and extraordinary literary masterpieces, who is not as well known here in the West as he should be.
And how did you discover him?
Through reading, I've always been interested in a very broad range of topics. Yeah. I think probably the last thing I would pick up to read would be an art magazine or an art journal.
Yeah.
But Rumi talked to me through the ages, and he has a way of just speaking in the most beautiful, profound terms. And William Blake is another one I've been very interested in,
poet,
who's a poet as well
right.
as an artist.
The black community
and, of course, the classics, you know, Velázquez and Goya.
But Buddhism, your own Buddhism play a role? Did one lead to the other? Or?
Well, you know, I don't consider myself really a practicing Buddhist per se. I've had experience with it. I studied with a Zen master in Japan when I lived there in 1980. I think the ideals of that religion, the ideals of compassion and a kind of openness to things has influenced me a lot. And in fact, when I discovered more about Buddhism in an intellectual way, primarily through reading before I went to Japan and experienced it directly, I felt a kind of a familiarity there that I think, again, I mean, so many of the things we're looking for in life, you know, people say, how do I appreciate art? What do I do when I go in a museum? I don't know the latest ideas and stuff. Just like, get rid of that stuff. It's about you connecting with something in the most fundamental way. You know, it's like, I like this, I don't like that. You feel something inside you that brings you into a relationship with this thing. I think that's the essential point. You know, you have within you, you know, we all have this creative power. It's something that defines who we are as human beings.
Of recording and reporting their proceedings to the public are going to adapt to the modern, effective, and reliable means that are available to make that reporting. Matter of fact, most of our courts in the country today still rely on shorthand or stenotype records, and that's the official record of the court, and then we have a typewritten transcript, and that's the official publication. But in my view, every courtroom should be equipped with a television camera mounted unobtrusively behind the jury and above the jury, so that there would be a jury's eye view of the court proceedings. And this would form the permanent record, the official permanent record of the court proceedings. Now, the publication of that permanent record, that official record, is just as simple a matter as presently the publication of our transcribed records.
What about the objection, Mr. Chief Justice, that ambitious lawyers and judges will use the camera to further their own interests?
I don't think that lawyers, judges, or witnesses would act any differently with the knowledge that their words and their actions are being recorded on a camera than in the knowledge that their words are being recorded by the stenotype operator. As a matter of fact, everything that's said in a courtroom is on the record, and that record is now public. It's my view that if we were to have this kind of a record of those proceedings, that we might, as a matter of fact, be able to get away from this insidious practice of trial by news conference, which is now plaguing the courts and confusing the people. I think that if we had this kind of a record, that the people would be entitled to hear what really transpires in the courtroom, not secondhand, not thirdhand, not after editorializing or condensing, but the actual record. I think the people with that kind of knowledge would tend more to support the processes of justice and the administration of justice than they do now.
Missionary in the form of homeless, battered, lying below it. And it is as though a life out of kilter, and that they are being drawn off and away from the picture, as though the picture can hardly hold these images within it, and that in fact these people are being sucked out of the world.
I was also interested in another part of not this picture itself, but one of the last pictures in this series, in which there was milk flowing out of the man's mouth and a bottle filled with blood on the fire escape next to him. I thought that was an interesting juxtaposition.
And yet, in that particular photograph, as I recall, the subject was in the dead center of the photograph and was, to my mind, less interesting.
Telling lies all your life, and it hasn't destroyed you yet, at least. You've convinced yourself it hasn't. But maybe the next one will. Yes, the damage of the negative ego is so powerfully and so prominently apparent. And you can look at your lives and see it, and you can tell yourself, and you can see it if you're willing to tell yourself the truth. But you know, the destruction of the negative ego, either potential or realized in your own reality, in your own creation, in your own physical world, at this time in your world is compounded. The problems, the destructiveness, the negativity that it can bring is compounded because of the uniqueness of the world in which you currently live. And there are several factors that make this negative ego even more potently destructive, even more potently damaging than has existed in the past. Although one could argue what's total damage can total damage, aren't they the same? But we would suggest here that that totalness can come much more incisively, decisively, can happen much more distortedly now due to several factors that are part of your world now. First of all, due to the very monumentalness of this decade that you are currently engaged in, to the shifting paradigm and to the changing patterns of causation, due to the relinquish of the power of the past and the increase in the influence of the future, at a time of information explosion and technological explosion, at a time when your globe, your world is no longer so big, when it is indeed truly you are existing in a global community, where actions and reactions and events can no longer be isolated. Indeed, in a global community where you have problems that seem to be insolvable, that affect you, whether developed or undeveloped, whether as a person or as a nation. You see, these conditions in this monumental decade where you are deciding whether to manifest a dream future or a nightmare future or a mediocre future that is even perhaps worse than either of the other two options. It is a time, what that does is produce an increased amount of uncertainty about the present and unsurety about the future. And negative ego seduces you by offering surety, by offering security. And therefore more people find themselves drawn to that negative ego by the very insecurity and unsurety of their reality compared to the surety and certainty that the ego promises, never delivers, mind you, but promises. Also, you are in a society, particularly in your Western world, but in many parts of the world now, in a society that is demanding upward mobility with nowhere to go.
With the Asia-Pacific meeting in Seattle, where the vision was finally consummated, with great praise, I should say. There was much swooning over the grand vision, the greatest rethinking of U.S. policy toward Asia in half a century. Headlines like Clinton preaches open markets at summit, with a major speech that Clinton delivered, in which he selected, he spoke at a corporation at the in the buildings of a corporation, which he designated as the model for his vision of the free market future for Asia. The corporation was the Boeing Corporation. He spoke in a hangar there and pointed out accurately that Boeing is the leading U.S. exporter. He could have gone on to say that civilian aircraft are the leading U.S. export manufactured item, $18 billion a year or two ago. I could have gone on to add further that the major, that the real U.S. comparative advantage in world trade these days is shifting from manufacturing to what are called services, and about a third of the export surplus is aircraft related, meaning tourism and that sort of thing. So we're really... It was a wise choice. That's the model that the free market vision for the future should copy. There are, of course, a few questions that could be raised. The idea of selecting Boeing aircraft as the model for a free market future does perhaps arouse a slight bit of puzzlement. Boeing, as is well known, is a publicly subsidized corporation. It is a private corporation, meaning the profit is private, but the public pays for it. Boeing wouldn't exist if it weren't for an enormous public subsidy that comes through the Pentagon and through NASA and so on. When you fly a Boeing airplane, as I did this morning, you're flying a modified bomber. The technology and the research and development and the avionics and everything else were paid for by the public, including the Boeing workers. And if indeed civilian aircraft is our, as it is, our major manufacturing export, and if tourism-related services are our major service export, that simply shows extensive public subsidy in which public funds are provided to what's called private enterprise for them to use to maximize the profit of their investors and owners and CEOs and so on.
We think the most
that's the model
thing
of the future.
Is spotting people
actually,
who
if
are
you
depressed,
free market
people
future.
Who are
if you look
too anxious
a little beyond
people,
into the small print
in
the laudatory articles, you'll find that the decision of the Boeing executives these days
those are all
is to carry out what the press calls, what the New York Times quoting calls, job-creating investment.
And today it's particularly tragic when people have a common disorder like depression, afflicting 10% of Americans, for which treatment's readily available, and they're not getting it because no one takes them by the hand and says, look, you're obviously not feeling well, and I know somebody who can help with this.
In the HBO special Murder 9 to 5 about murder in the workplace, you interview Richard Farley, who killed 7 and wounded 4 employees at the corporation where he worked after he was fired 2 years before. Tell us a little bit more about his crime.
Richard Farley had taken an immediate interest in a co-worker, Laura Black, a young engineer, and had pursued her in inappropriate ways from the time they met. He'd only been at that facility 2 weeks when they met, and at that point, the right thing to do would have been to intervene and make sure that she and he were no longer working at that facility, and it was apparent from the outset. What he did was to follow her everywhere, obtain wax impressions of her keys, break into her personnel file, and even the papers regarding her security clearance, and made her life miserable through his pursuit of her. He's a classic example of what really deserves the term stalker, though that term's much overused these days. And for 2 years, he did this to her in the workplace before the company finally got rid of him. They had resisted firing him because he threatened to kill the human resources manager when he was counseled about this behavior. They made some ineffective efforts to get him into treatment, and it was treatment of a kind that wasn't going to work for him anyway. And 2 years after he was fired, having continued to stalk her for those 2 years, he then entered with multiple weapons, 98 pounds to be precise, of weapons and ammunition, and he killed people and shot computers and equipment as he went through the facility. By the time the smoke had cleared, there were 7 dead and others wounded, including Laura.
She was wounded?
She was shot in the shoulder, and it took several reconstructive operations for her to be able to get up and about, and she's well recovered now.
I want to play an excerpt of the interview you did with Richard Farley, the murderer. He's in prison now?
Yes, he's awaiting execution on death row at San Quentin.
And was this interview conducted expressly for the HBO program?
Yes, it was, and it was the first interview he'd given.
What do you think that Laura Black could have done to prevent the shooting?
Treated me a lot differently than she did.
You mean go out with you?
Go out with me, yeah. Yep. That would have worked.
But she didn't want to go out with you.
I agree. She didn't want to.
There came a time that you thought of killing yourself in front of Laura.
Yes.
Did you think of taking her with you?
I don't believe I ever thought of that. I mean, my intention was not to hurt Laura in a physical manner. Psychologically, traumatize her, make her live with the experience of having my blood and guts all over her is one thing. But to physically hurt her, that I never intended to do that.
Hearing Richard Farley say what he did about how, well, she should have treated me better, she should have gone out with me, is there anything that Laura could have done to prevent what happened?
There's nothing Laura could have done to stay in that job and prevent this tragedy. Nor was it her responsibility to prevent this tragedy. It was the company's responsibility once they learned that they had such an inappropriate, harassing, threatening employee and later former employee. Now, there are things that women in that situation can do to protect themselves, but some of them require great sacrifices that people aren't prepared to make. The same is true for women who are being pursued by former lovers instead of strangers or co-workers, as was the case here.
Why is it in America that going somewhere, buying something, calling someone, just about any transaction you can name in America is as nerve-wracking as a Bosnian grocery run? Why is it that seemingly everyone with a job along the great service highway is an uninterested sociopath with the interpersonal skills of a Wolverine? I don't want to get off on a rant here, but why is it that... Why is it that I can't seem to go through the simplest major hassle with anything? For example, I recently subscribed to a magazine. After paying for it, they sent me another bill. I called them to rectify the situation. They assured me they'd correct the problem. I then started receiving two copies of the magazine each week, one addressed to Dennis Miller and the other addressed to Denise Miller. Now, I want to know two things. One, how can they not know they're sending two magazines to the same address? And two, how did they find out about my cross-dressing? You know, nowadays, half the people you ask for help say, it's not my job, man, and the other half don't have a clue about how in the hell to do their job. See if this sounds familiar. Hotel clerks who, even though you requested a non-smoking room, give you a suite that smells like Dennis Leary's index finger. Maids who don't give a shit about the do not disturb sign and come through the door like Pete Wilson raiding the kitchen for green cards at El Pollo Loco. Movie. Movie ushers who constantly ask you to remove your feet from the seat in front of you, but refuse to even shine their flashlight on the gang initiation golden shower taking place during the Lion King. In trendy restaurants from the Upper West Side of Manhattan to West Hollywood, the one dish you can be sure is on the menu is attitude. Now, I know all these waiters and waitresses have the talent to be the next Luke Perry or the next Luke Perry. And excuse... Couldn't think of anybody else that bad. And excuse me for wandering into your restaurant in a quest for sustenance to jam in my pie hole, but from the time you strap on your Buford Pusser pepper mill to the time you drop your last check, do all of us hungry patrons a favor and use your sense memory to portray a wait person who gives a shit about the customer they're serving, even though that customer rudely insists on not being Mike Ovitz, okay? And you know, it's not like I don't sympathize. I've been in the vast service gulag. After I graduated from college, one of my first jobs was as an ice cream scoop at a village dairy in Pittsburgh. I'm standing there at age 21 in a paper hat with my two fellow employees asking me if they're going to find the driving test hard. And the prettiest girl from my 5 years ago senior class walks in to order a cone. She recognizes me and tries to cover her discomfort by making awkward small talk about sugar versus cake, as I think, yeah, I'll get laid on this planet. Sure I will. And I once had a job cleaning toilets for a living. On the night shift, for Christ's sake. Got that? I didn't even rate cleaning toilets during the day. My bosses actually thought to themselves, yeah, Miller's good. He's real good. He's just not ready for the show yet.
Photography has always been an important form because it allows people to use their eyes in ways that that life itself does not offer. Life itself is transient. Life itself is temporal. Life itself has flow. As Tony has said, life itself is an obscuration of truth, whereas photography is a way in which the eye can help the brain to achieve a sense of what is real.
Photography gives us one thing, which is that our perceived reality is only in the blink of our own eyelid, and that photography is a reflection of that. And I'm happy to be part of that reflected moment.
Well, I think that we must all remember that it was really the invention of the image of duplicating, trying to record something and duplicate something, that people first really began to become civilized. And I think that photography does something towards helping helping mankind achieve a balance in a chaotic world.
Discourages you. When the explosion of information and technology gives you more to think about and more to feel about, the society tells you not to bother doing so. Not to bother doing so. And this becomes fuel, this becomes raw, explosive, inflammable fuel for negative egos to exponentially increase their hold. And the fourth influence that is going on, that both on a global and national and then indeed on a very personal level, people are experiencing greater levels of chaos, greater levels of insanity in a personal way, global way, in a national way, greater levels of panic, greater levels of pity. And therefore more and more people are relinquishing their power, throwing up their hands, shrugging their shoulders, closing their eyes, and relinquishing their power to a negative ego. And therefore not just developing the dependencies that perhaps you used to have or that your parents' generation or before had, but now creating what are called co-dependencies, co-dependent relationships upon negative egos. And many of you here, what 5 years ago used to be dependent, now find yourself co-dependent in a relationship with that negative ego as more power gets relinquished in a chaotic, in a seemingly insane, in a panicking and at times much easier to pity yourself in world.
Those pizza, yeah, I love that pizza. What about it? Don't you like it? You sound like you'd love it.
I happen to enjoy Jericho's.
Yeah?
All I wanted to say to you tonight, Mr. Champlain, was I have an interest in this place, or at least some certain friends of mine.
Just use one syllable, Billy. I mean, if it's really difficult. Oh, Billy,
right.
Michael.
Hey, smart guy.
Just use one syllable.
Hey, smart guy.
Oh, we're being...
Hey.
We're, smart guy.
Hey, smart guy.
We got somebody with a little lip on us tonight.
Hey.
Yeah, hey, what? Don't call me hey. My name isn't
this
hey,
is
okay?
This is not a conversation. This is a monologue. I talk, you listen. You understand me? You understand me?
Oh, yeah. Okay, we're listening. Yes. Go ahead.
I don't want you making any more of these comments about the place, all right? About the pizza joint.
Well, why do you have relatives that run that place?
There are people who got to make money
on this. Uncle Vinny or something?
There are people
who got to own it, huh? Hey, you know what I think, Michael? I think you're a meatball. Debbie out in Highland Park.
My name is Debbie.
Yeah, hello, Debbie. Good. How old are you, Debbie?
I'm 23.
What do you do, Debbie?
Well, I don't do anything.
Well, when was the last time you did something, Debbie?
I don't know. About a month ago.
And so codependency itself is one of the phenomena that makes the damage and the devastation of a negative ego even more profound than it used to be.
It's not that people are weaker. It's not that humanity is somehow de-evolving, but rather the conditions that seduce, that call, that whisper, that demand a dependency, a codependency upon your negative ego are increasing. And so to begin to look at tonight's topic, to begin to explore ending your personal codependency, it is important to first of all understand and figure out what codependency is. And to do that, it is perhaps important to first state that codependency is not just a bigger dependency. Many people, often looking for the simple answer, often not wanting to evaluate or to form opinions or to make assessments or discernments, often people looking for the no-think answer, will say that, well, I know codependency is bad, and any dependency is codependent, and therefore all dependency is bad, and therefore simply see as what might be a dependency, something you can hold in your hands, as a codependency, just a bigger thing, just a bigger it, a bigger dependency, more of the same, and therefore it's destructive, and therefore you should conclude and end all dependencies on yourself, upon others, upon truth, upon what's real, upon what's not. You just don't be dependent on anything and you'll be safe then, because they see codependency as just a bigger dependency, and that's not what it is. Others say codependency, co, that means more than one. Okay, two people depending on each other, that's codependent and bad and terrible. So don't depend upon anybody, or don't rely upon anybody, because that could be dangerously close to codependency. And neither of these definitions are true. Both of them are simple definitions. Both of them are what we call the no-think definition. That's easy just to throw everything out that looks at, feels, or in any way is reliant or dependent or involved with anybody else. And therefore, ironically, producing very isolated, very lonely, very alienated people who are so terrified of codependency that they eliminate dependency. But you see, dependency is part of human nature. It is part of human nature to learn to rely upon, to depend upon, not everybody, but upon a discerning few that are called intimate. And indeed, in the very process of learning to love, in the very process of learning to be intimate, in the very process of learning to care, are you not indeed learning to depend upon and to be there for others to depend upon?
Chiffonier. That chiffonier would look good in the corner.
Certainly. You depend upon your relationship with God, Goddess, all that is. That is your spirituality. Learn to depend upon your ability within yourself, but also to depend upon God, Goddess, all that is, to depend upon your higher self, to depend upon those co-creators, those unseen friends, to depend very much upon your spirituality, to depend very much upon your metaphysics. No, it is human nature to develop dependency. There's nothing wrong with being dependent, but when that dependency becomes destructive, then it becomes what is called a co-dependent relationship.
And over the years, I've learned to exchange the balance so that now I have more moments of joy with less moments of sorrow.
Let me go back then. I mean, this is a quote from you. When I thought of beauty, I thought of acceptance and walking through the world and through a room with grace and fluency that I couldn't imagine. And I wanted to be beautiful. At least that's what I thought. What I really wanted to do was to walk through a room with grace and fluency. And it took me an incredibly long time to realize that I could do that. That's what I wanted, and that's what I had to go after. And a lot of women who want to be beautiful, what they really want to be is loved and accepted, you know, and there really is a distinction between the two things.
Etagere. To display this collection best, we really need an etagere.
Fauteuil.
Is it going?
Would look for that area.
Sound would be.
Merci.
Fleur de lis.
Montreal, Cohen holds up in a $3 a night hotel room on the Tenderloin.
Well, you always have a feeling in a hotel room that you're on the lam. And it's one of the safe moments in the escape. It's that breathing spot. The hotel room is the oasis of the downtown. It's a kind of temple of refuge. It's sanctuary. Sanctuary of a temporary kind, therefore all the more delicious.
Jardiniere. We could place a jardiniere in the hallway.
Marquisette.
An artist seemed to be able to touch Marquisette. It deeper and to offer it for
Marquisette
others.
Marquisette curtains to connect the most them. Attractive
they,
on that window.
I mean, you know, when I was a kid, I was the class artist. You know, I grew up in Queens.
Wow.
And when it came time to paint the Pilgrims Landing on Plymouth Rock, you know,
fabric
with a hat with a big square buckles on them and stuff, I was the guy who did that. You know, I've always been doing that.
I want to get this in before we get too far past here. This mm-hmm. is running out of time. The Greeting. Tell me about it.
The Greeting is a piece that's part of the exhibition that's on now in Venice at the Biennial. And The Greeting is a work that was conceived as an image on the wall of a room. Other installation works I do involve the whole space with multiple images. This is a single image. And it was loosely based on a painting by Pontormo, who's a 16th century artist who I was interested in. And the interesting thing about it is that it's a very common social situation of three women. There are two women and one woman enters while two are there, and they meet each other and greet each other. But the interesting thing about it was a shot at 300 frames a second, actually on film. And so very simple, normal events that occur in flashes become extended as a kind of a choreography or a ballet in time.
Here it is. Take a look.
A month ago.
How I swim.
Mm-hmm. What do you do for money?
I got my brother. I haven't made any.
Debbie, you're 23 years old. You're a leech. Don't you think it's time you got off your duff, started making some money?
Well, not really. I got everything I wanted.
Yes, but Debbie, what do you need?
Well,
what are you missing that you need?
I wouldn't agree with you. Respect me, approve and appreciate my point of view.
Well,
my advice will take, but as if you have any queries or reservations about the wisdom of my counsel or indeed of my identity, then strip off the James label before you put on the jeans. Still see if they fit. If they do not fit, of course you may hang them back on the rack. The question is not who gave it to you, but is it good for me? If you ultimately totally take on, not take on, but make it your own, then it is healthy for you to assimilate it fully, whether it be healing, whether it be love, whether it be advice, or whether it be wisdom. When it enters your province of your own aura, of your own identity, then it does indeed become yours, even as this answer is now entirely yours to do as you wish.
Put away.
He's a disgusting human being. My life. He suggests that racism ought to be the most important thing that any one of us ought to listen to in this court, that any one of us in this nation should be listening to. And it's because of racism we should put aside all other thought, all other reason, and set his murdering client free. He's a sick man. He ought to be put away.
The photographer claims he's an artist because if he moves his lens a half inch to the left or to the right, the fact that he has that choice, that is the difference between a good picture and a stupid picture. So what makes it a creative art is its selectivity of what you show and what you don't show in a picture. Good evening, you're on the air. Could you tell me something about yourself? Hello?
Hello.
I'd like to know just a little bit about what you look like and what you're wearing.
I have shoulder length brown hair, blue eyes, freckles, and I'm wearing a blue t-shirt and army fatigue.
Army fatigues. Well, that sounds lovely. And could you tell us the setting in which this series of photographs will be taken?
Well, I'm sitting in my living room.
Yeah.
On the floor. And I have a gun.
You have what?
I have a Ruger Security 6, 357
Magnum. Uh-huh.
The gun's empty.
Yeah. And you're holding a gun, and what? How would you like to pose for this photograph?
Okay. I'm leaning forward.
Yeah.
I'm sitting cross-legged, leaning forward.
Yeah.
And I'm aiming the gun.
Yeah.
At the camera.
Oh, I like it. Okay, here we go. Ready? Like we're shooting each other.
Yes.
Would you like to try another position, another pose?
All right. I'm taking a bullet.
Yeah.
And I'm inserting it in the cylinder.
Okay.
The camera is behind my head.
Okay.
With my point of view.
Okay.
As the bullet slides in. All right, I'm closing the cylinder. And I'm just about to cock the gun. And the camera...
is that. Sorry to be so blunt, but that's burgundy. Fat. Burstingly burgundy. So. But also soft. So fatly soft. So softly fat. That you begin to wonder, really, how does burgundy, soft and as fat as it is, manage to keep up? Where does it hide its huffing and puffing? And the deep, deep drowsiness after the tall dinner. Come, come, big burgundy, what do you weigh? How much have you gained since the beginning? Beautiful, burgeoning burgundy, big, big burgundy, fat, 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 as a burgundy cat.
You can unbuckle now. Feel free to roam about the passenger area. But don't touch anything. Everything was decided in the past. You can't remember everything that was set up. So use etiquette, like in other real cultures. Mind yourself. And don't wake any of the other passengers. This is a 12-hour flight. And you know what you've got to do.
You want to reverse it around when a relationship becomes codependent. Taking on certain very unique and very distinct qualities, when a relationship becomes codependent, then it becomes destructive, no matter who it's with. And therefore, to understand, we need to look specifically at what is codependency. And there are four criteria, four very specific, very detailed criteria that are involved in what is a codependent relationship. First criteria. In order for a relationship to be codependent, it must involve a dependency that demands adherence. A dependency that demands adherence to oppressive rules. That demands adherence to oppressive rules that limit or eliminate the open expression of thought and feeling, or that limit or eliminate open communication. It's a dependency that demands adherence to an oppressive set of rules that eliminates open communication or open expression of thought and feeling in a relationship between two people. We cannot talk about my mother. We cannot talk about my job. We cannot talk about how much money we earn. We cannot talk about how come my brother's doing better than me. We cannot talk about the fact that we don't make love but once every blue moon, which is once a year. We cannot talk about this. We cannot talk about that. You must have this done. You must have that right. You have to have this done. This must be the way the house looks. This is the must way you act. This is how often we can have friends over. This is how much you can speak on the telephone. This is strict rules that must be adhered to. Demands that strict adherence to oppressive rules. And that there's no room for open communication. Can we talk about why we can't talk about your mother? All right, that's it. No more. That's it. I'm out of here. Gone for the night, down to drink. Can we talk about why you gambled away the entire paycheck? Oh, now you've made me feel terrible. Now you're just trying to destroy me. That's one of the rules we cannot talk about. Now those are the four criteria. Those are the four criteria. Now, do you have to meet them all? No. But we would suggest here that generally you have to meet more than one. If any of these two, or three, or four conditions are met, and usually in a codependent relationship, all four are met. But if any two, you are in a codependent relationship. You are participating in a codependency. Now, fortunately in your world, now there are those who are dealing with codependency publicly, openly, support groups for AA, support groups for spouses of alcoholics, Al-Anon, or spouses of drug abusers. There are those support groups for abusive parents, for the adult children fill in the blank. There are support groups for children in those on for those who are affected in that same thing. And that's fantastic, finally. And appropriate in the world where codependency is now on the increase due to the phenomena of the decade, due to the lack of upward space in which to mobily move, to put yourself, due to the demands of perfection and performance, due to the lack of thinking and feeling that is pushed and demanded of you. When codependency increases, it is appropriate that there are those places to get help, absolutely. But often what is forgotten in dealing with the codependent, on a point that is so very important to consider, as painful as it is to consider it, and that is a codependency meeting any two or more of these qualities is mutual. Meaning that as this person is demanding adherence to oppressive rules that prevent me from communicating openly, so I have my own set of oppressive rules that I am putting on them. I will not talk to you until you stop drinking. I will not talk to you until you get a decent job. I will not talk to you unless I can do it during your most favorite show. I will not do this unless you meet my criteria. And though the one who identifies themselves as the codependent often doesn't see, but they also, if they will look, have their own set of oppressive rules that eliminate their own and the other person's communication. The diminished capacity that I experience by not being able to love and be loved and give love are also diminishing the other person's capacity. They hold it, or they see it in that capacity, rightly or wrongly, they hold it in that capacity. Well, I see it that their behavior controls me, and therefore I've got to control their behavior in order to be free. They see that your behavior is what's making me do this, and I've got to control your behavior in order to be free. And where that relationship has developed such excessive needs and exaggerated needs of control, both parties feel controlled by the other. And needing the outside validation of the other, sure they'll never get it. Both are crippling and woefully neglecting themselves. Now, admittedly, the one who is acknowledging that I am in codependency with so-and-so, often doesn't see the other side, doesn't want to see the other side, and gets angry at seeing the other side. But the way out, as we're going to talk later, also is dependent upon and reliant upon, perhaps a better word, reliant upon seeing the mutuality. Co, in this case, doesn't mean two. It means mutual. Co-dependent. We're both depending on the other to play the role so that we can both feel oppressed by the rules restricted in our communication. We can both have diminished capacities of initiating and of participating in love. We can both feel the other one is controlling us and the only way to be free is to control them. We can both work with these various upsides or downsides of control in an exaggerated way, seeking that outside validation, never getting it. We can both be crippled and we can both woefully neglect ourselves. The mutuality is, in a sense, the umbrella over these four conditions.
Draw your knees in, up come your legs, and we're going to work on the lower abdominals today. We're going to focus in on that area. So what we're going to do first of all is we're going to lift up and then down. What you're trying to do is you're trying to press your toes up, trying to touch your toes to the ceiling, to the sky, wherever you're exercising, wherever your television set is. There you go. Now, if you like exercising in shorts and t-shirts, that's great. But again, make sure that there is a cotton blend. Very important. Up and down. And also, ladies, please wear bras. Very important. Gentlemen, you don't have to, but the ladies should, okay? Because your chest is really designed, it's predominantly fat tissue, but there are pectoral muscles that actually support the actual breast. So what you want to do is you want to help those muscles. So by wearing a brassiere, you'll be doing
it. These will make real nice Christmas presents. Thank you very much. First of all, I want to thank all the fans out there for making this possible. They're the greatest. And we're having the greatest label in the world, Atlantic Records. And, yeah. And let's see, there's a lot I forgot. But anyway, it's been a great year. Thank you all very much. And hopefully I'll be back again, huh?
Pectoralis major, minor, trapezius, and the deltoid. Keep going. Now let's take a little ski hop into it, left and right.
Martin's going to be an imaginary person, right?
Yeah.
Good, do that again. How about four more? Woo! Good. Two. One more set, come on.
You walk like that?
Well, it depends. It depends who's walking behind me.
There you go. That's
look
it,
at this.
Right,
this is great.
Perfect.
Now, can you tell me one more thing? I'm going to put this back up, like, in the regular position.
Okay.
I see something here. Tell me a little bit about this pulse. I believe it's a pulse jack that it's plugged into.
Right. That's called, this is your pulse monitor, and you clip this to your earlobe.
To my earlobe?
It's actually a pulse in your ear.
Okay.
And while you're walking, if you give that a few seconds, you'll start to register your pulse. And that's really important for you to know.
Oh, yeah, there it goes right.
And I did that exercise
because then you can keep track of what your, where your heart rate is in your training zone.
It's interactive. You just...
Okay, so yeah, so it's so clear that we're dealing in bulimia and anorexia with life-threatening, deadly diseases, and I'm going to be suggesting to you in program two that these diseases are created by the whole attitude toward beauty, our whole moral judgment on fatness as bad and evil, and that there's something wrong with fatness. and that thin is good and fat is bad, and that both of these women began with diets. That is, bulimia is a kind of diet. There's a place where Denise talks about all the gals in high school, you know, eating the chocolate cake and then going and vomiting.
Filled out another timesheet for overtime, and I never received a check.
Excuse me, sir? I'm going to transfer you to accounts payable, okay?
Well, no. Well, but I'm going to... Okay.
Hey, Milton, can I borrow your Thomas register for a minute?
Well, I loaned it to Dale last week, and he never brought it back. And then I needed it for the AIU DCP project, and I had to go get it.
Where is it? Down here?
So, I would prefer not to loan it out.
Oh, here it is. Thanks.
Well, okay, but if you don't bring it back, I'll tell Bill it was stolen. And I could have you fired. Well, and I'm gonna put strychnine in the coffee.
Oh, Ray?
Yeah?
Are you using Milton for anything right now?
Nope. He's all yours.
Great. Thanks. Oh, and, do you think that he's got...
He's probably not good.
Yeah, I know. Okay. Thanks a bunch. Bye-bye.
Oh, hello, Milton. What's happening?
Well, I was told that I could receive overtime on the AIU DCP project, and
That's going to be kind of tight on the overtime.
But I was told that they...
Yeah, we're really short on billable hours.
Well...
In fact, I'm going to need you to go ahead and take the rest of the day off.
But,
so, if you could just go ahead and clock out as soon as possible, that would be terrific. Okay.
Well, okay, but...
Oh, and if you could just kind of go over those AIU DCP files at home tonight, that would be great. Okay.
Well...
Thanks a bunch, Milton. Bye-bye.
But... Well, okay, but I could have you killed.
Okay, enough picture taking for tonight. This is Joe Frank. See you next week, the same time. Good night.
Recently, I've begun affecting surgical garb, so I'm here in a scrub suit. I'm wearing the kind of green V-neck top with short sleeves, baggy green pants with a loose tie with a tie string around the waist. I'm wearing open sandals, and I have a bandana around my head. Normally, looking out my window, it would be just an everyday street scene with ice cream vendors, kids, dogs, and stuff. But as you know, in my neighborhood here in Rancho Virago, we've been having rock storms. So the local foliage is, I would say, pretty well destroyed. The cars are kind of dented. People are moving very, very slowly, picking their way around large boulders which have fallen from the skies. It's really an amazing sight, and I think very distressing as well. I have a green glass window, and I have an onyx fish tank where I'm unable to look into the tank unless I lean over the top. And the room itself is a pretty bare, modern room with Danish furniture. By Danish, I mean in the shape of sweet rolls and pastries. The rug is a threadbare Karastan. It's very dark. I don't like to have much light in my room. And recently I've been growing mushrooms. I have a large number of petri dishes and Erlenmeyer flasks, which are filled with microbial life. I've been growing penicillin mold in one of the drawers of my desk. And psychologists say that you can discern deep psychological insight about people by the family photographs that come out of their albums. For instance, I know that from the family photographs that we take, it's possible to discern whether my wife is late with her menstrual cycle. I can tell by glancing at a photograph of my son whether he's been clever in the bathroom in a way that we'll discover later. So I would say that family photographs are an integral part of interpreting one's life, and without them, things would probably be a lot easier.
We are against this particular toy because we feel it is dangerous. You see? Ah, there you go. Right there. Very, very dangerous toy. So to parents, we say, no! We will not buy this particular toy. Be right back with Howard Stern right after this one.
She's not feeling too well, and she couldn't make it tonight. We brought her along anyway. Everybody say hi to T-Bob.
Well, let's see. You want to start?
Yeah.
First of all, we have to thank our Lord Jesus Christ for making all of this possible. This is wonderful. We have to thank our mothers. We love you all so much. Without you guys, we wouldn't be here. And our wonderful, wonderful producers, Babyface, Dallas Austin, Jermaine Dupree, Organized Noise, Marquez, Arnold Henning, our record company, LaFace Records, L.A. Reed, we love you very much. Babyface, Billy Woodruff, Devette Singletary, be patient with me, I'm going, y'all. Lisa Cambridge, I got it right here, I got it. This is a tearjerker too.
Locking off the elbows on the top, give me a slight bend. Inhaling on the way down.
Our whole LaFace crew, we love you all so much. Radio, without you, they would not hear us. MTV, BET, VH1, without you guys, they wouldn't see us.
Once a month. Supersetting is a great way to get into body parts.
Everybody, we love you all, and most of all, our fans, because of you, we are the number one.
Bring her shoulders all the way, and her elbows all the way down.
The biggest girl group ever in history, and Crazy Sexy Cool has sold 8.5 million albums. Thank you, we love you.
The reason I'm shutting my eyes is because I like to concentrate, and also because the Maui sun is rather bright.
Blaring down on us.
Three more.
I thought because you're having so much fun, you're thinking about other things you could
be
doing right now.
No, I am having fun with you guys.
There you go.
And last one.
Always under control.
Do you work your triceps as much as you work all the other body parts?
It's a good idea to train each body part at the most twice a week. If you're just starting out, once a week.
Giving out needles to drug addicts.
They have to do it, darling. They're trying to stop AIDS. Clean needles help.
It's immoral for the government of this country, tax dollars, to be going to addicts.
Oh, but it's all right, Rhonda, for our tax dollars. 4 billion of them to go into a system that's a complete joke. More drugs than ever are coming into this country. Our courts, our jails are clogged with cases. The other night up in New York City, those crack dealers killed another cop. And any kid who wants to hit the
dead one,
right?
Conditioned with a set point that can't change. In fact, one of the most important things that we're going to do in Program 3 is talk about how you can change the set point. And there are some known ways to change the set point. But the set point is like an internal ideal that the body has that monitors weight. And the fat stores are regulated and measured by the body through internal mechanisms, not through what you eat or what you don't eat. For example, here is Dr. Bennett again. When a person goes on a diet, the body reacts to stringent dieting as if a famine had set in, because you're starving it. The metabolic machinery shifts to a cautious regimen designed to conserve calories. Obese people put on extraordinarily restrictive diets. So if you're put on a very restrictive diet, say a few hundred calories a day, drop their metabolic rate by about 15% in a few weeks. What that means is that this internal regulator does not need as much energy in order to operate. It reduces the amount of energy that it needs, that somehow this thermostat knows how to do that. Regardless of the fact that they are still obese, this internal mechanism is controlling what's going on. They function like thermostats regulating the body's fat stores and weight, okay? Changes in fat stores increase or decrease the appetite. This is set point theory. So there's something that's coming from the fat stores in the body telling the brain. It's sort of like the fat stores are going, oh my God, he's starving us again. Come on, guys, let's have a meeting.
And all the cells come together, and they say, he's starving us again. And so here's what happens. After I get through starving them with this carbohydrate, no carbohydrate diet,
there's no need to
then when I start eating again, they say, hey, you store a little more, you store a little more, because he may do this again. He may start starving, he may induce another famine. So let's save some, so that if he does go on another one of these diets, we'll have a little extra. And that's why in 3 years you put on 3 pounds.
A lot of women are skeptical about the mere existence of the G-spot. But after carefully following the plateau effect described in this program, many women have experienced a Grafenberg orgasm. The knowledge of its existence explains intense sensations that women have been trying to express for years. This spot also helps other women to experience new types of orgasms, different from those produced just by clitoral stimulation. These orgasms feel deeper, last longer, and often more satisfying.
Just going to leave it. We'll be out in a little bit too. Let's get right to it. My first guest, very shy, withdrawn kind of man. Ultimate America's most famous radio personality, best-selling author. This is his new book, Miss America, the fastest-selling book in American history. Say hello to Howard Stern, ladies. Tattoo. I noticed one of the girls has a tattoo on her back.
GJ, that's very interesting that you noticed the tattoo after all the breast implants. That's incredible. I would notice those first. Jay, let me tell you something.
All
I've done you.
What you like. Go
first
ahead.
Of all, I want to congratulate your new band leader. There's a guy who's happy, he's smiling, he's having a good time. Look at that. Not angry to be with a white man, nothing like that. You know, Branford had a bunch of issues. I think he was a little angry with the white man. You have none of that. I love you. God bless you. You're wonderful. Wonderful. Big smiling guy. Like that, the races can't get together, Jay.
There you go, that's a good.
Thank God Branford left, that's all I can say. Now listen to me. Jay says that too. Jay, I decided tonight that you've been crowing about the fact that you've been beating Letterman. We read the report.
I've been crowing, yeah.
We read the ad. Back, but you know, to tell you the truth, both of you guys have nothing to crow about. Your ratings haven't been that stellar. Is this true? I mean, occasionally Nightline does beat you both, and even Jenny Jones reruns beat you once in a while. So I came out tonight to give Jay a little lesson on how to get ratings. I guarantee you that tonight is the big night for The Tonight Show. It's about time. It's about time that we... Jay, it's about time that we broke tradition on The Tonight Show. You know, every show now has been taking my advice. You know, I always said lesbianism is the top thing in America. Everybody loves it. Everybody loves lesbianism. Jay, and let me tell you something. I've been saying it for years. And now all of a sudden on network television, you see a lesbian kiss. Well, Jan had a lesbian kiss on her show. But The Tonight Show, to my knowledge, has never gone this route. Am I correct? Thank you.
need a bad movie that we can build it around.
Oh, I see. You would need that.
Yeah.
Well, let's do that then. Let me give it a try. Let's see what happens.
But how do I think that?
You really do think it'll be edited out?
It's beyond my control, Howard.
I don't believe it. Let me try. One spank, Jay?
It'll all be edited.
Just one, Jay. Jay, you don't understand. If you don't break the barriers, if you don't go and break the barriers of television and you don't expand the medium, it'll never be done.
So this is sort of the golden age of television.
Think of me as, Jay, think of me as the Sid Caesar of the 90s. I'm breaking all the rules.
No, I think you move.
It isn't really necessary to know exactly what times were allowed to place we're speaking about airports, but they are all over the world. What does matter, however, is the feeling of the synergy between the airports and what you want to bring about. That seems to me to be the point of the entire exercise.
Culture, you have learned to work one thing at a time, one set of influence at a time, and at a relatively slow pace. When a shape comes to you, you may only receive one aspect and say, gee, it's blue, that was very nice, I enjoyed that. But in fact, it was not only blue, it might have been contained within it everything you needed to make a great change, psychologically, emotionally, and physically. All you received was the color blue. Very sad. A great opportunity passed you by.
we have offended the couple. Now we apologize to the circumcised male who are present. It is a bad thing for us to say this to you. What, you have to go back now and take care of it, do you see? You forgive your mother. Say, oh, it's okay. I know that you did as well as you could. And I'm just fine. My sex life is great. You can do this little bit of appealing. Carl, you do this. You see, we have a shell. Okay, now, where do we go? You know, speak of transform sexual energy to spiritual. It is an old tradition, not original to say sexuality and spirituality go hand in hand. You know, this is not new. Yet, although you know it, it doesn't quite make sense. What does that mean? It means if you have a big, strong sexual feeling, it is very easy to pull the energy up and project it any way you want. Creativity, strength, compassion, love, understanding, and clairvoyance, divine feeling of contact with what is divine. It is the same energy, but you want it to be big down there where it starts. Root chakra, Muladhara, base of spine. This is a chakra of physical being. If you are alive, this is active. Second chakra, Svadhisthana. These are, you know, centers of radiating energy, not in your physical body, but associated with places on your body.
Beauty is, you know, it's a word of a few letters that really is a label for all those other things. And we mistakenly identify it as being equal to all those things that you just listed, just ease of being, grace, and fluency. We forget that, so we go after beauty. It's just, you know, you could take the same dynamic and apply it to money, you know, wealth, you know. Really what we, using the universal we here, we want that sense of belonging and acceptance and security. And you somehow think that wealth will give that to you. It will give you many things, but it doesn't necessarily give you those things. They're independent, and wealth and beauty are separate. They're labels that those other things exist in the category of.
And this is an easy shot, but is it, who determines beauty?
That's not an easy shot at all. I don't know why you would think it was.
Well, I'll tell you why, because a lot of people will say, you know, want to say, it's easy to just say, well, the problem in America is that we hold up, the media holds up this, some kind of ideal as to what beauty means. And if you don't fit that definition of beauty, then you're ugly. You're not beautiful. You know, some arbitrarily determined, and that therefore, that's the problem, many people will say, is that you have to be slim, you have to be beautiful, you have to be all this stuff that creates enormous, enormous problems of self-esteem.
It's definitely part of the problem, but it's also more, it's like a common language or a rhetoric that we all use to talk about, well, this is how it should be, and we forget that things really exist in dialogue, you know, and if somebody says it should be this way, then there are going to be an equal number, if not more, people saying, well, no, actually, maybe it should be this way. And it's far too easy to say that the media, the fashion industry,
right,
the beauty
industry
are the enemy, and that subjugates women into this, like, pathetic, you know,
right,
role of the victim.
Victimization of women.
And it's really not true. Also, a lot of people really want me to say, you know, it's not important. It's not beauty in this ideal, you know, slim, whatever. It's not ideal. That's entirely not true. It's very important. The truth lies somewhere in between. It's very important, and it's utterly irrelevant at the same time. They're both paradoxically true at the same time, and it's much more a very personal journey. I could never claim that this, that I want to start some kind of a revolution. It's amazing how people want to put that onto me. That's just not true. This is a very personal journey of finding your own meaning.
She had long dark hair. She was never so old. She was never so young. Shout out the sky. She would cry. She would run. There was a place she would walk every day. She would sit by the river. In the grass she would lay. She was never so.
She would sit by the river.
similar to buildings look very similar.
Okay, buddy, have a good holiday. 1-800-780-PETE is the number to...
Wow. Well, we never won anything before, so I guess we'll start out by thanking our fans. Yeah. And everybody who bought Throwing Copper and who came to see us this year in concert. We want to thank everybody in the business who has helped us over the past, well, a lot of years. It's a long time coming. Thank you so much to everyone. You know who you are. Last but not least, we want to say peace to all our troops in Bosnia that are landing there. We're going to serve there. We wish them, surround them in light, as my mother would say. And peace. So come home safe. Thanks again, Billboard, for the award.
I refuse to get
take care. Thanks.
I have to be desperate to do that. Barbara Streisand running shorts.
Do you have enough money?
Yeah, she has enough money. Come on. Barbara Streisand running shorts.
A black sweatshirt for $80.
Oh, my God.
Showcased at premieres.
This is the Pimp Daddy Macintoshes cowboy look, and somebody made me dress like this.
And I'm wearing my jeans, tight tore up jeans.
And I cut my hair for this. Yeah. Okay.
In metaphysics. In metaphysical learning, you can develop codependencies, but only if there's a call, if there's a mutuality. There are those who teach metaphysics that tell you, you must follow the rules. And you cannot question, and you cannot doubt, and you cannot think, and you cannot read other books, and you cannot study other material. You must adhere strictly to the rules, and it does limit your capacity. Communicate your thoughts and feelings. There are those in the metaphysical community that similarly diminish your capacity to initiate relationships. You've got to find a relationship within the group, within the cult, within the family, yes, within the followers. As you segregate yourself in somewhat of a quasi-military state, we're the knowing ones, and those heathens out there are the unknowing, those unevolved ones, and you can't associate, you can't involve yourself with them. Where indeed there is that feeling that I've got to get my guru's approval before I can grow and change. But that's the only way I can do it, if they give me permission to do that. Where indeed that outside validation to win their approval, the exaggerated needs of control, and people end up woefully neglecting themselves and their families. Yes, even within the beautiful realms of metaphysics, codependencies can develop, but it must be not only that I feel that, but it's there in a mutuality. That in that sense, that generates the codependency. And yes, codependency is an influence that is destructive, obviously by its very definition. Codependency is a destructive influence. Negative ego is a destructive force. When you combine a destructive influence with a destructive force, the result is singular and obvious. Destruction. And you see, in a world with these monumental changes, with shifting paradigms, with new patterns of causation, with a past that is relinquishing its power and a future that is gathering its influence, with a global community in which it is now small, such that actions and reactions cannot be isolated, where there seem to be problems that have no solution, where there is upward mobility and nowhere to go with the demands of perfection and performance, when you are discouraged to think and feel at a time when thinking and feeling is the only answer in many cases, and in the chaotic, in the panicking, in the insanity and in the pity that is so much a part of your world and increasingly so, it is very easy to slip from a dependency upon a negative ego into a codependency, where you slip into a relationship with your own negative ego where there are strict rules to follow and you are not allowed open communication, not allowed to think or feel and express your thinking and feeling, where your capacity is diminished to initiate or participate in loving relationships because of the dependency that you've held upon your negative ego. You've convinced yourself that your negative ego is controlling you, and unless you control your negative ego, you'll never be free. You've convinced yourself that in that sense, control, I gotta control it and you and my child and my adolescent and the weather and the day and the night and everything about everything that's happening, or I'll never get anywhere. I gotta meditate four times in the morning, gotta run my energy, gotta do this, gotta talk to my counselors, gotta work with the co-creators, gotta do 14 different meditation techniques. And if I do, I'm going to get all this validation, and I end up neglecting myself and neglecting those around me because of the dependency upon even the destructiveness of my own negative ego. And therefore, in your world now, more than ever, it is important to recognize and acknowledge, forgive, and most certainly change to end that codependency. And in this year of exploration, not only a time to be free of your self-pity, but a time to end the codependency that you have or are developing with your very own negative ego. And so to do that, and to help you do that, not only to learn, but to experience, and not only to learn and experience, but actually to begin walking away, not from your ego, but from your negative ego and the codependency, we begin by looking at the origins of this thing called your ego in the first place. So often we have heard from individuals and in various times in groups, if I create my own reality, as though that were a conditional point. If I create my own reality, why would I have created a negative ego? Why would I have done that? And when did I do it? What lifetime was it that I was so stupid and so foolish as to, so ignorant of everything, so naive as to... Well, it's important to understand that initially you did not create a negative ego. You created ego. You created ego. That went sour. So to begin in that sense, we need to look at this creation of ego. Where? What is it? Why is it? And we would suggest here that to understand that, we have to take a very cursory glance at the development of consciousness. For as you as consciousness decided to grow, one of the first questions that you answered, do you want to grow? Yes. Okay. If you answer no, then forget it was even asked. But nonetheless, and if you answered no, you would have forgotten that it was ever asked. But nonetheless, you answered yes, and then that sends a series of questions, not the least of which is, do you want to do it in a density that's called physical? And you said yes to those same series of questions. We said no, and therefore the differences between us began. But nonetheless, you said yes. But you see, you didn't just pop into a human form and start living a high life of physicalness. Not at all. What you first began was as energy. And to sort of illustrate this, you began as energy. Raw energy. With no form, no distinction, no direction, just raw energy. As that energy, you were searching for something. And what you were searching for, in your language, would be called God, or in what we call God, Goddess, and more specifically, all that is. Raw energy is in search of all that is. And from its perspective, its concept of all that is, causes it to grow and to form itself, to create a form. To create a form of energy that is called subatomic energy. Neutrinos, quirk. You see, energy that is raw has no direction, no form. But as it takes form and starts rotating at a frequency of vibration, some of that energy becomes neutrinos. Others of that energy become quirks. Others of that energy become those subatomic particles that your scientists are giving rather cute names to, such as faith and charm. Has no weight, nonetheless is energy that vibrates at a particular frequency. And that's form, as abstract as it seems. And from the raw energy, that's pretty nifty. To be able to hold a form. Whoa, that's pretty nifty. Eh? That's really getting closer. But it isn't all. It isn't all yet. So subatomic particles then form themselves into atomic particles. Atomic particles, those things that you call electrons and protons, and the space that is in between. In other words, the material, the stuff that makes up an electron are neutrinos. The stuff that makes up a proton are neutrinos. The stuff that makes up the space in between the electron and the proton are neutrinos. But they're all vibrating at different frequencies. So one looks negatively charged like an electron. The other looks positively charged like a proton. And the other looks like it's not even there, like the space in between. But your scientists discovered that there's a tremendous energy in that space in between, such that causing a smashing of those atoms, called fission, produces an atomic and a hydrogen bomb, which now in your world now people are starting to reconsider their destructive capacity of the space in between. So it's not empty. It's more powerful often than the neutrinos that form the electrons or that form the protons are the neutrinos that form the energy in between.
Grudgingly gave them back to us. You know, I was like, here's your kids, you know, you can move on with your life now.
What effect has all this had on the two of you?
Financially, we had to file bankruptcy, something we didn't want to do, but we really had to do that. Becky lost her job over it, and we are getting billed for everything that happened to us. The court-appointed attorneys, they make us pay for that. All foster care, down to, you know, clothes, food, everything.
Medical examination.
Right, just everything involved with the whole thing that they want us to pay for it.
So they take your children away, they put them in foster homes, they put them through medical examinations, and then they make you pay the bills.
Right.
It's just unbelievable.
It is, it's unbelievable.
And it continues to happen. Thousands of lives in England, the United States, Holland, Canada, New Zealand, torn apart as the notion of an international satanic conspiracy has come to influence more and more people with power. Police, bureaucrats, social workers, and now ministers of the church.
At this point, these raw energy evolving, searching for all that is, becomes these subatomic particles. And these subatomic particles, searching for all that is, come to become the atomic particles. They become an electron. Could you believe it? I'm an electron. Isn't that fantastic? And I'm getting closer, because from the electron's point of view, all that is has to be an atom. Oh, that's got to be what it is, to be not just an electron, and not just space, and not just a proton, but to be the whole thing, has got to be all that is, to be an electron, a proton, and the space in between, a hydrogen atom, one electron rotating around the proton, that's got to be all that is. But it's not. And as it reaches that stage and realizes this isn't all that is, it then forms without atoms, right? It forms with other atoms to form molecules that then move it to the next kingdom, which is that of the minerals, right? It becomes a mineral. It becomes a mineral. Well, boy, that's pretty nifty. That's quite a growth, but that's a whole new level. Now, what runs this level? What causes this level to run? Basically, from the raw energy to subatomic to atomic to atom, it's chemistry, pure chemistry.
Arthur. Hey, Arthur.
Are you there? Can you hear me, Arthur? Arthur, answer me.
Is that it? You want me to come in and get you out?
Yeah. Oh. I want to get a look at those EEG tracings. States. A lot of religious allegory, mostly out of Revelation.
Ew, isn't it close to 5 hours?
It felt like an hour.
I'd like to try that myself sometime.
You should, you'll like it. Do we have any communication?
Oh, sure. I kept checking you out like you told me to.
How'd I respond?
Very orderly.
At one point, you were crying.
You mean actually crying?
You were sobbing. There were tears on your face. I asked you what was going on. You said you were re-experiencing your father's death.
Did you make notes?
It's all there.
I'd like to try this again next week, Arthur. Do you think you can make it again next week?
What are we looking for?
I don't know. Yet.
There's really very little literature on this kind of research. There's some good people in the field.
Chemical relationship between the energy and the ether is what drives it. What drives it? When you reach this next level of minerals are quite sedentary, whether they are the slightest molecule of gold or silver, or whether they're entire mountain range, they're still quite sedentary. They can get around, but not when you're looking, at least, and other things. And but they're unsatisfied. Minerals aren't satisfied with being minerals. They want to become something more. They too are in search for all that is. They're in search for that all that is. And then they become part of the plant kingdom. Plants are really fantastic compared to minerals, because plants can move one direction vertically, but they can move. That's quite an evolution. Well, I thought plants moved upon the ground. Yeah, to them, that's vertical. It's all in the point of perspective, is vertical growth. Vertical growth, and that's wonderful. And then it moves on to that of the animal kingdom, which is really fantastic, because they can move in two directions. They can move laterally and vertically, and that same thing. That's fantastic, but still it's not all that is. And then they reach this thing that's called what we call the human animal, which is quite special kind of animal, because you can move laterally and vertically, and also with depth. You can remember where you've been in that regard. And we would suggest here, but that's got to be all that is from the mineral point of view. Boy, that human animal thing, that's got to be all that is. And that's got to be all that is. And all of them, then they get there, that's not all that is. There's got to be something beyond that of being the human animal, which you move into the next stage, which is in that same thing from human animal in that way. Human animal, if you will, to that stage of being the human being. The human being that has consciousness, that has a conscious awareness of their consciousness, if you will. That human being that becomes what we call the magician, or that of the metaphysical human being, that becomes then the spiritual person, the spiritual person or the spiritual being. And that's got to be all that is, but it's not. There's another layer that involves your higher self, etc., etc. But we're not concerned with that tonight. We're concerned with these three levels to understand where you are and where you're going. All right, chemistry runs this level. But on this level, from mineral to plant to animal to human animal, you need more than just chemistry. You need now biology and instinct. So here is, atoms don't have instinct, nor do they have a biology in the sense they have a chemistry. Once you move to this level, in order to move from mineral to plant, you got to add biology, you got to add zoology, whatever. From a plant to animal, you got to add biology. You had to have instinct.
You've put up with me all these years.
I loved you.
My God, Emily, I don't know how to tell you this. I really don't. The implications are staggering. Apparently, I entered a very primitive consciousness, and all I can remember is what was comprehensible to that consciousness. I don't remember, at least not clearly, how I got out of the tank room. The first thing I remember are the dogs. I followed a pack of wild dogs to the zoo. That's how I got there. In the zoo, I hunted down, killed, and ate a small sheep. I was utterly primal. I consisted of nothing more than the will to survive, to live through the night, to eat, to drink, to sleep. It was the most supremely satisfying time of my life.
Instinct, and the human animal in many ways functions on instinct. There aren't any human animals left in your world. They all reach the level of human being now. Some people may seem to function like animals, but they're human beings now. But you need biology, you need chemistry, you need instinct. But once you become a human animal and start moving, that's not enough. You got to have an ego. You got to have an ego that's going to do more than biology, do more than zoology, do more than chemistry, do more than instinct. You got to have an ego that can remember. You got to have an ego that has the ability to function and work. And so in order to survive, you created an ego. Not to destroy you, not to trip you up, not as the monumental obstacle of your life, but as a friend, as a part of you that's supposed to help you function, that's supposed to help you grow, because your chemistry couldn't do it alone, though your chemistry does an awful lot. And your biology couldn't do it alone, though your biology does a tremendous amount. And though instinct, now called the autonomic nervous system and an involuntary nervous system, instinct does an awful lot, but you need more than that. You need an ego. And thus you develop an ego. Understand what your ego is supposed to do, and admittedly a lot of people haven't thought of it in this term, but it's important to understand that in your reality, which you do know, you have many worlds. You have many different worlds in your reality. You have a physical world, right? That you know very well, or at least say you do. You now have this physical world, and what's supposed to happen is that there's a certain amount of content in that physical world. And your ego is supposed to deliver the content to you. That's how you perceive in your world. How you know that this room has the kind of lighting that it does, that it has the kind of carpet that it does, that it has the chair. That when you came in the door, your ego delivered the information of dimension and which side of the room, and this side, middle side, that side, and delivered the information to you. You, as a conscious being, have charge of the context and the form. The conscious mind or the conscious world has content. You then have the context and form. As you came into the room and saw the setup and where the chairs were and where the stage was and where the channel would be sitting and this sort of thing, that information was delivered by your ego. Now, it was up to you to put it in the context, since I'm here to learn and listen. I therefore want to sit in the front. Since I'm here to learn and listen, I therefore want to sit in the back. Ah, that's silly. You know you don't sit in the front. You know you don't sit in the back. You know the only place you can learn is in the middle. So I'm going to sit in the middle, and I have to sit on the right side. No, silly, it's got to be the left side. No, it's got to be right in the middle so I can see the blackboard and all that sort of thing. You decide, put it into context for yourself. Because I have problem hearing, I want to sit near the microphone outlets or to the other speakers. Because I have an oversensitivity to hearing, I want to sit away from them. Because I tend to be cold, I want to check for air conditioning ducts and not sit under one. Because I have a tendency to be, oh, it's always close, always close. I therefore want to find one of those air conditioning ducts, and I want to sit under it. Therefore, I determine the context in this change. Now, if you came here to square dance, this room is all wrong. But if you came here to come to a workshop, hey, this is right, this will do it, absolutely. So the context and the form, and then you deliver back after you perceive from what the ego gives you, then you conceive what you can do about it. And you direct yourself to sit there, here, there, whatever in that same thing. You decide the context and form, but you see, that's just your physical world. And this is the job of the ego. That's what it's supposed to do, to give you the information, wait for your response, and then carry your response back. We've related it like a person who works in a mail room. They're supposed to bring the mail up to the CEO, slice it open and deliver it to the inbox and wait for anything to go to the outbox and deliver the mail and take it away. That's all the ego is supposed to do.
Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Dear Heavenly Father, we are grateful for the things you have given us. Pray that you'll bless this food to our
Jim and Fran Field are devout Christians, but that hasn't spared them from charges of Satanism.
Amen.
Jim and Fran have now lost their only daughter, Cynthia, who has been persuaded that they tortured and abused her in satanic rituals performed when she was a child over 20 years ago.
Living in this house that Cynthia grew up in since sixth grade, occasionally it's like living in a tomb. You walk through the house and it's empty.
Tulsa, Oklahoma, sometimes described as the religious capital of America.
You and the kids. I just wanted you to know that.
You saved me. You redeemed me from the pit I was in it, Emily. I was in that ultimate moment of terror that is the beginning of life. It is nothing. Simple, hideous nothing. The final truth of all things is that there is no final truth. Truth is what's transitory. It's human life that is real. I don't want to frighten you, Emily, but what I'm trying to tell you is that that moment of terror is a real and living horror, living and growing within me now. And the only thing that keeps it from devouring me is you.
Why don't you just come back to us?
It's too late. I don't think I can get out of it anymore. I can't live with it. The pain is too great.
Fire, Eddie. You made it real. You can make it unreal. If you love me, Eddie. If you love me, Eddie, get fire!
the content and take the content away. That's what it's supposed to do in your physical world. But you have more than a physical world. You have this world that we call the inner world. The inner world of your own programmings, your own ideas, your own beliefs, your own attitudes that have been planted there since childhood and all through that. Beliefs, attitudes, thoughts, feelings, choices, decisions, such precedents that you've set, platitudes, cliches, the whole shooting match, it's all there. Now, who delivers this information? Well, this information is delivered to you by the subconscious mind. The subconscious mind is the one that lets you know what content it has. What's the content of this world? What beliefs are there? What attitudes are there? This is delivered by the subconscious. You, however, are still in charge of the context. You are still in charge of the form. Example just happened in the most recent intensive just the other day. A woman in that same gym discovered in our talking with her that she had in her subconscious a belief that people who are sick and weakly should die. And that was laying there in her subconscious mind. Now, as she brings that up, as the subconscious delivers that to her, hey, you know what? You hold the belief that people who are weak and sickly should die. And she looks at that and says, right now she's suffering from a disease herself. She is weak and sickly. Uh-oh. In this context of my own weakness and sickness, that's a belief I want to change, or I may just go ahead and die. So therefore, she would take that, put it in the context of her reality, in the form of her current reality, and deliver back a message, reprogram that sucker. Now let's change that belief. And let's change it fast, and that's saying clearly so. But it's the subconscious that delivers the information. Tap, tap, tap. By the way, just wanted to let you know, in your dreams, in your meditations, in your daydreams, in your night dreams, in the gestalts of awareness, in the reflective mirror that reality is to you, your subconscious is delivering all kinds of information. But you're supposed to take the context and the form consciously and then decide what to do with it and re-deliver that information via the subconscious. That's the role of normal meditation. Beneath that, you have this place that we call the underworld. Now, in the context of religion, that sounds like hell or Hades or some terrible, awful place. We're meaning it as the room and role and place of your unconscious mind, the underworld. And that has information also. That's where all your little time bombs are located. You know, all these beliefs that as soon as you make it, then you gotta crash. As soon as you're totally happy, then you gotta die. As soon as something works out wonderfully, then something awful must happen, knock on wood. In that sense, you know, if you ever should brag about yourself, knock on wood. All these kinds of not really beliefs and attitudes, but they are instincts, if you will. Your instinctive responses in that particular regard. To cringe when somebody raises a hand to you, or to cringe when your life is going great because any moment the other shoe is going to fall. Whatever, in that same thing, lie deep within that unconscious mind. And in that same thing, it's in that underworld. And it's your unconscious mind that is supposed to deliver that information for you to work with the context, and to you to put it into form, and then to deliver back information to that underworld, to replace the instinct, if you will, with new responses. Beneath that, there is the higher realms, in that same thing, even though it seems somewhat of a contradictory term, the higher realm, which in that same thing is the realm of your spirituality, of your relationship with God. God is all that is. And it's your higher self, the higher self that delivers the information, that gives you the insight and information. But you're supposed to still give it meaning by putting it into context and putting it into form. And then you deliver back to your higher self what you want to do about it. The higher self tells you this is your dream, or this is a piece of your vision. But you've got to put it into context. You've got to put it into form. And in that same thing, then deliver back to the higher realm, deliver back via your higher self what you want to do about it. That's the function in your four worlds, and each of them has an eye. An eye through which you can perceive. Each of them has a doorway through which you can conceive. And in your highest of high worlds, it's your higher self that is your eye, and it is your portal, so that you might conceive and perceive respectively. In the underworld, it is your unconscious mind that is the eye to perceive and the door in which to conceive. And in your subconscious inner world, it is your subconscious mind that delivers the information that is the eye to perceive and the door to conceive. And in your physical world, it is your ego that is your eye, so that you might see the content of your physical world. Without an ego, you couldn't see it. What would your eyes register? What do they register now? Light. They register light. It is the brain that turns it in, and the ego that is delivering to the brain, in the sense, the meaning of that life, the content. You are then to give it form and context and respond. And the I is the ego, and the door is the ego in the physical world. That's why we have always said, don't kill it. You don't pluck out your own eye. You don't nail shut your own door. You're cutting off yourself from your world to do so, any more than we would suggest to kill your subconscious or unconscious or your higher self. No, nor to dismiss it, nor to ignore it. All need your attention. And this is how it's supposed to function, and this is what you created, and this is why you created it, so that you could do all this. You needed a door here. You see, as energy, and through that kingdom to atom, as mineral through the kingdom to human animal, you can function without this full awareness, without being able to control and take charge of the context and form, but not as a human being. And therefore you needed a new door. A door called ego. You needed a new I, an I called ego. Wonderful, fantastic, beautiful creation. Bravo to all of you for doing that. Really brilliant work. But it went askew. Something went very wrong. Something went very wrong. And what happened is this. When your ego is new, brand new, it is what we call an infant ego. An infant ego. Between the time you're born, we'll call that zero, and somewhere between 7 and 14, between 7 and 14 somewhere. Some of you a little earlier, some of you a little later, but somewhere between 7 and 14. Between 0 and, let's say, 13 or 10, just to be on the middle side. You have what's called an infantile ego, an ego that is concerned, am I getting enough? Am I getting enough? Am I getting enough attention, enough love, enough airtime, enough space? Am I getting enough? Am I getting enough? Am I getting enough? Enough food, enough sleep, enough protection, enough security, enough belonging, enough. Am I getting enough? That's the phrase, and that's what the ego ought to be doing. And as you look at children, that's what they're concerned about. Yeah, do I have enough toys? Do I have enough this? Do I have enough food? Did I get the biggest half of the candy bar? Did I get this? Did I get that? Did I get... The infantile ego, this only measures reality by getting enough. But at a certain point, you realize quantity isn't all that is. Quantity isn't all that is. There's something called quality. And then you move to the next phase of your ego, and the second phase of your ego we call the image-based ego. From infantile ego to image-based ego, that's the time when you ask yourself the question, am I good enough? Am I good enough? Now that starts when the other ends. So somewhere between 7 and 14 it begins. Your second phase begins between 7 and 14, depending upon when the first phase ended. Obviously if it was ended at 8, then no one begins at 8, and etc. For each of the several 7 years that fall in that range. Somewhere between 7 and 14 you move into the image-based ego. Am I good enough?
Questions to ponder. The captain is on board. Bosun's whistle has sounded. Captain Rio is ready to take over. That's about it for New Metaphysics. Another time around the big wheel. Spiraling outward. I'll see you all next Thursday, 10 o'clock, till 2 a.m. We'll do it all over again. Gary Geiserman right here. WZBC in Newton. A legend of broadcasting. Living in your world. Congratulations. You could just as easily not have this. Different parallel reality. Or you could have 20 of these. Twenty ZBCs. all variety of auteur radio. If you'd like a free catalog of Lazarus tapes, the gentleman we've been listening to, 1-800-678-2356. Ask for the catalog. 1-800-678-2356. Be good to yourselves. I'll see you next time. Ta-ra.